The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damien Thompson. There's been a Christian community in Syria since the 1st century AD. But it is shrinking fast and faces terrifying threats as the country's new government, following the overthrow of President Assad, forges alliances with hardline Muslims, including foreign jihadists, Uyghurs from China, Uzbeks from Central Asia, Chechens from Russia, Afghans and Pakistanis. Monsignor Michael Nazar Ali, the former Anglican Bishop of Rochester, who's now a Catholic priest of the Ordinariate, has written a heartbreaking piece for The Spectator about the Christians of Maalula in southwest Syria. It's one of the last remaining communities to speak Syriac, a dialect of Aramaic, the language of Jesus Christ. Were this community to be destroyed, something precious and irreplaceable would be lost, he writes. Yet that is exactly what may happen. When the then Bishop Nazar Ali visited the town in 2016, he discovered that the predecessors of the jihadis who've toppled Bashar al-Assad had systematically destroyed and desecrated the town's churches and monasteries. Orthodox nuns were kidnapped and held to ransom. Young men had been singled out and executed when they refused to convert to the extremist version of Islam. Will it happen again? Ahmed al-Sharaa, head of the new Syrian transitional administration, has told church leaders that they have nothing to fear. But can he be trusted? As Monsignor Nazar Ali told me earlier, it is time for the West to act.
Monsignor Michael Nazar Ali, welcome back to Holy Smoke. It's always a great privilege to have you on the podcast. The peg for this interview is an extremely alarming article that you've written for The Spectator about the uncertain future, to put it mildly, facing Syrian Christians. And you begin by talking about your visit to the small town of Maalula in southwest Syria. And you point out that the precursors of the people who drove out Assad were extremists who kidnapped Orthodox nuns and who systematically destroyed and desecrated the town's churches and monasteries. And you also make the point that it is one of the homes of Syriac Orthodox Christians who speak a dialect of Aramaic, one of the last communities speaking a dialect of a language spoken by Jesus Christ, the Holy Family, and the Apostles. And as you say, were this community to be destroyed, something precious and irreplaceable would be lost. I'm also very keen to ask you about the presence of foreign fighters in that region. But if you could first tell me a little about what Maalula represents to you and the freedom and the heritage that might be lost.
Yes, Maalula, Damien, is widely known to be a center for the speaking of Syriac, a dialect of Aramaic, spoken by our Lord and also by the Holy Family and the Apostles. There are very few communities left now that speak Syriac as their mother tongue. Maalula is one of them, and it has Christians in it from different denominations. So there are Orthodox Christians, but also there are Eastern Rite Catholic Christians there, and indeed others. When I visited, this was soon after the Syrian army had retaken the town from Jabhat al-Nusra, and I was able to see the destruction that had been caused to monasteries and churches. Altars had been desecrated. It wasn't just destruction, it was also desecration. And I visited families. Many of these families live in houses that are in the side of hillsides and mountainsides for their own protection. That is how they have survived these many centuries. And I had harrowing tales of one family I visited, a blind father and a daughter looking after him. And they told me that their young men two brothers, I think, and a cousin had been marched out by the militants, told to recite the Kalima, and when they refused, they were shot. This matched, of course, these tales matched what I could see with my own eyes in the sort of physical destruction and desecration. This story is not unique. It was repeated in many parts of Syria during the civil war, and Christians felt very much under threat at that time from different wings of the militants as they were then. Once the people who had been these militants had come to power after the removal of Assad and the Ba'ath Party, it was very worrying then to note that Maloula seemed to be under attack again, with reports coming from there, people being shot at, confiscating of properties, their properties, threats to their safety. And this was followed by reports from other towns, like in other parts of the country. And then, of course, the great demonstration that took place in Damascus. The Christians in Syria are not as politically active as they might be, you might say. But just before Christmas, even they were compelled to demonstrate against the pressures they were under. Yeah, it's a cumulative, really, the what is happening.
And I wonder if we could just give listeners some idea of the magnitude of the religious historical disaster we might be talking about, because I believe there has been a Christian community in Syria since the first century, and indeed 20 of the 325 bishops from the original Council of Nicaea were from Syria. It's produced three popes. And until quite recently, there were 1.5 million Christians in Syria in 2011. And now there are 300,000, and there could soon be a lot fewer. And it's a very distinctive heritage that's being lost, because as you point out, they worship in the dialect of Aramaic. Could I just ask you a theological question?
Certainly.
Some Syrian Christians, Syriac Christians, are not mainstream Orthodox, are they? They're Church of the East. Are they Monophysite? Do they have a distinctive theology?
Yes, there are a number of traditions there. So the largest churches are the Melkite Catholic Church and the Syrian Orthodox Church, which is Miaphysite, which believes that Jesus had one nature in which the divine and the human were inextricably united. There are other Eastern Rite Catholics, like the Syrian Catholics, who are different from the Melkites. There are some Maronite Catholics. There is a small Church of the East, as you call it, the Assyrian Church of the East. And of course, there are the Chaldeans. So the East Syrian tradition is now largely represented by the Chaldeans, who are, of course, in communion with Rome. Rome, by the way, if that is what you were asking, has now said that both Miaphysite doctrines and the Church of the East doctrines fall within Orthodoxy as Rome now sees it. And so there is Eucharistic hospitality in certain circumstances.
That's quite a history. I mean, this will seem very specialist to lots of people, and really it's way outside my territory, but that's quite a historic shift in a way, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes.
I mean, that's a historical dispute that goes back well over 1,000 years, isn't it?
Oh, it does, yes. It goes back to Chalcedon and even to the Council of Ephesus in 431.
And it probably doesn't make sense to most, you know, secularized Christians in today's world. It's difficult to grasp. But let's get back to the situation in Syria. To what extent have these worshipping communities already been destroyed?
Well, you see, I went to Aleppo, and the media reports had been that Aleppo had been destroyed by the forces of the Ba'ath Party and Assad. When I went there, I found that 7/8 of Aleppo was just okay. I mean, it was in a war situation, but it certainly hadn't been destroyed. The hospitals were open, the schools were open, the doctors were working, shops were open. 1/8 of the city, which had been under militant control, had been heavily attacked by the Syrian army, the then Syrian army, and had been, you may say, destroyed. But we had an ecumenical service in the Armenian Evangelical Church that was attended by all the different church groups in Aleppo at the time. And just before the service, a whole number of Muslim clerics turned up and said they also wanted to be part of this because they did not agree with what was happening to Christians and other minorities. And so they did join in our service. Many people were displaced. There were many refugees, as you say, many Christians fled to Jordan and to Lebanon, and some eventually to the West and other parts of the world. This happened in Iraq, of course, with so-called Islamic State, and has now been repeated in Syria.
Indeed, you know, you could look at Palestinian Christians who, yes, one way or another, have been displaced mostly to America, hugely changing the demographic, religious.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, from 23% of the population to now maybe 2% or 3% in Palestine.
What I found particularly alarming in your article, if I can just quote from it, you say one element, yes, in the confusing mix that is Syria today is the presence of large numbers of foreign fighters from, yes, the tribe of Uyghurs, Uzbeks from Central Asia, Chechens from Russia, Afghans and Pakistanis. You mentioned the incident of the burning of a Christmas tree was the work of some of these foreign fighters and that they're embedded in the army. How did this happen, Monsignor? Who, you know, what's the process by which these foreign fighters found their way to Syria?
I think what we have to realize, Damien, is that the radical Islamist movement is a worldwide movement. It is not restricted to any particular country. It was given impetus by the West's assisting of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation at the time to get rid of the Soviets, which it did succeed in doing. But in the process, it produced an international radical Islamist movement, or several movements, we should say. So although Arabic, for example, has a perfectly good word for terrorist, Irhabi, in fact, the colloquial word very often for a terrorist is Afghan, meaning not people who are ethnically Afghan, but those who were trained on the killing fields of Afghanistan. We are now seeing the harvest of that with the Taliban in power.
And I was at school and at university at the time, and my goodness, we thought of the Mujahideen as heroes and freedom fighters. And I even remember donating to buy them a machine gun or something, like the Russians. But we had no idea what we were dealing with.
Well, that's right. You see, I mean, and this, well, we now see the fruits of it. But I remember pleading with people, I was working in that area at the time, and pleading with people not to arm these groups, not to support them. And I was told, well, these are the only people who can bring freedom to Afghanistan. Well, we have now seen what kind of freedom it is.
So looking at today's situation, you mentioned, really surprisingly, China's Uyghurs, who, of course, are horribly persecuted by Beijing. But how might a Uyghur find his way from wherever he's based, presumably in China, perhaps being persecuted there? I don't know where. But how would he find his way to Syria?
Well, through Pakistan. I mean, it borders Pakistan, that particular province.
And where would he pick up the jihadist message?
Well, there are many of these people are being trained in the radical madrasas in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But there are radical parties. I mean, this is not in any way to excuse what Beijing is doing to the Uyghurs. But there has been a process of radicalization in that group, as much as in many other situations in Central Asia, for example. This cannot be denied. And it may well be, and I think it is the case, that some of the governments in Central Asia have become paranoid about this and have put restrictions on religious freedom because of their fear of Islamist extremism. But we cannot deny that it exists.
Something you and I have talked about before, Monsignor, is frustration at the lack of interest in public opinion at the persecution of Christians, which has been at unprecedented levels for decades now, and which simply doesn't seem to interest the international community very much. I mean, our mutual friend Lord Alton has campaigned heroically.
Yes.
Gone all over the world campaigning about it, spoken almost every day sometimes in the House of Lords about it. He found himself being fought under the Tories by the Department for Overseas Development, who just weren't interested in it. During the Biden administration, interest in religious freedom dropped to an all-time low under the presidency of supposedly a Catholic president. We shall have to see whether the campaign for religious freedom and the focus on the persecution of Christians is revived under President Trump again. But it seems that there's almost nothing we can do to raise the proper level of awareness. I mean, we also, of course, have to think about Nigeria, where perhaps the worst atrocities of all have been committed by so-called Islamist settlers or whatever they call themselves. And one thing I did wonder was, to his great credit, the king is interested in this subject.
Yes.
He does take an interest in it. I know the constitutional limits to what he can do, but I wonder if there's any chance that the king might help to raise awareness of this problem?
Yes, I think he has raised awareness of it. And of course, there are many other people who are doing that. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom does that in a way that Britain should emulate. I've said that for a very long time, by gathering data and publishing it and ranking countries according to the threat they pose for religious freedom generally. I mean, not just for Christians.
But Biden's State Department was just not interested.
No, I know. But I mean, there is now a structural way in which the commission can bring to the State Department's attention and the presidency's attention what is happening. Now, how they respond to it will vary, of course, from government to government. We're going to see a change soon, I hope, in this area. I think there in Syria, it seems to me that a number of steps need to be taken. First of all, it should be made clear to the present regime there that sanctions will not be lifted unless there are guarantees of freedom of expression, freedom of belief, freedom of worship, all of those things. And secondly, I think we need some kind of grand gathering about Syria, which includes internal as well as external parties to this conflict, all of them, to come to some sort of agreement about the future of Syria. I mean, it cannot just be left to rebels who, with external backing, have managed to capture the country. I mean, that's not... What is the democratic future for Syria?
May I ask you how much interest there is in, you know, Vatican Secretariat of State in this subject? Are they giving it a high enough priority? They certainly do mention it, but is it a high enough priority?
I think they have been engaged, but I don't know what the most recent situation is, but there are some very good people in the Vatican who are themselves from the region and know from their own experience what is happening, who will certainly be able to inform the situation. But in Syria particularly, the present state of affairs is so unclear that one doesn't know quite what to say and how things will turn out. But what I'm saying is that the international community has certain means to influence what happens in the future, and it shouldn't let go of those means too easily.
Exactly. If I could just give a shout out to my great friend, Father Benedict Keeley.
Who is also my great friend.
A priest of the Ordinariate. He has worked tirelessly and at huge risk to himself to rehabilitate not just Syrian Christians, but Christians in the Middle East, and draw attention to other atrocities. And very impressive that, you know, two priests of the Ordinariate, a prelate yourself and Father Benedict, are working so intensely hard from a small community, often sneered at, to my fury, by both Anglican and Catholic mainstream, the Ordinariate, to draw attention to this. I wonder if I could ask you about a meeting that was held at the beginning of this year, as the Catholic News Agency reported, on January the 4th, as Syria negotiates a transitional phase, there was a meeting between Ahmad al-Sharaa, head of the new Syrian transitional administration, and church leaders at the People's Palace in Damascus. Yes. Now, al-Sharaa emphasized that he'd grown up among Christians. He'd spent many years with Christians and was very well disposed to them and wanted them to play an important part in the life of the new Syria. How confident are you that that will come to pass?
Well, it depends what he means. He has also said that freedoms, including religious freedom and freedom for women, will be according to Islamic polity. Now, I know what that means.
Why?
Yeah, that I know what that means. I mean, so what you may get is a sort of dhimmi status for Christians and other non-Muslim minorities, particularly the Ahl al-Kitab, the people of the book, which in Syria's case now are just the Christians. You may get freedom to worship, but no freedom in any way to profess their faith in public. There will be restrictions on things like external symbols of the faith, on processions, on publications, on even on dialogue. You know, so I want to know exactly what that means. And the only way to discover it is to say, look, until you tell us exactly what you mean, we cannot remove sanctions on Syria, and we cannot agree that this is the sort of final political dispensation, because in no way is it democratic. So it may be that he has really had a change of heart, but has he renounced the bi'ah, the allegiance that he had offered first to ISIS and then to Al-Qaeda? Has he renounced that? Has he publicly said he has renounced that? I would welcome such a renunciation as a sign of something new.
One thing that would make a difference? My criticism of the present pontiff is pretty well known, but I mean, I was appalled when he basically supported the banning of what he called proselytism in the United Arab Emirates. But either he or the next pope, you know, a stronger witness from the See of Peter, I think might make a difference. But I'm given the nature of the Beijing deal, I'm not particularly confident. And I know that other Catholic priests working in this area aren't particularly confident, which is why, in my opinion, it's very, very, very important to have people like you, Monsignor Michael, and Father Keeley maintaining a witness, and also a witness, you know, a similar witness from Anglican and Protestant leaders.
Of course. I mean, my interest, and I'm sure this is true of Father Benedict as well, that is simply to tell the truth as we have seen it, and to be a voice for people who are at this time voiceless. I mean, you can't say that religious leaders, Christian leaders in Syria are able to say what they feel. I mean, this is just not, you know, this is naive to think that these journalists who are going up to them and saying, you know, how is it for you? And they say, well, it's fine. Well, they have to say that. Someone else has to speak up. And we need to make sure that there is an atmosphere of greater freedom of expression for people to be able to say whether they really are free or not. You see, the Christians, in a way, are privileged because they are Ahl al-Kitab. They are the people of the book. Yeah. But there are other minorities in Syria, like the Yazidis, for example. I've met Yazidis in Syria, and they are very apprehensive about what may happen to them. There are even the sort of heterodox Muslims, if you can call them that, the Alawites.
The Alawites, yeah.
Now, you know, what protection is there for them and for the Druze? And there are other groups like the Murshidis.
Was an Alawite, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yes. But the Alawites now, you see, what's going to happen in a Sunni Sharia dispensation to heretics like the Alawites or the Murshidis or the Druze?
Indeed, it's a very good question. Well, at least you will be there, Monsignor Michael Nazarelli, to speak out. Thank you for what you've said already. And I look forward to hearing other prominent clergymen join their voices to yours. Thank you very much for appearing on Holy Smoke.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, David.
Thanks.